Today we look back on the career of a British magazine that changed the way youth culture was covered in print. Plus, fans of the Scandinavian model of masculinity are in for a treat. And the resurrection of a Japanese magazine for city girls. All that ahead today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. The middle ground shared by music, fashion and art long ago metastasized to become a landscape in its own right. Nowhere has this process been reflected and shaped more than in magazines. These days, more titles than not blur the boundaries between cultural categories, but that hasn't always been the case. One of the first and most influential magazines to willfully knock down the barriers between different aspects of youth culture was The Face, founded by British journalist Nick Logan in 1980. Now, 13 years after its final issue left the printers, a new book from Thames and Hudson takes stock of The Face's remarkable career and its massive impact on culture. Here's the author, Paul Gorman, talking to Monocle's Henry Rees-Sheridan about his new book, The Story of The Face.
I was 20 when it was published. Actually, when the first issue came out, I'd been a working journalist for about 18 months or so. I was working indentured on a trade paper, part of the Thompson International Business Press. And so I'd been a downline sub, I'd been a copy boy, I'd even taken photographs, I'd written features. So I kind of knew and was beginning to learn the trade of producing magazines. At the same time, I've been following the career of Nick Logan since the early 70s. When I was 12 or 13 in the early 70s, I bought my first copies of the NME, and he became editor of that in 1973. And actually, looking back and writing this book, you realise that what he did with The Face, which was to contextualise music and fashion and various aspects of popular culture within a wider social context, and he started that at the NME.
Yeah, tell me a little bit more about the print media environment out of which The Face grew, because it's billed in the blurb for this book as the first magazine that investigated youth culture beyond music. But what came before it?
Well, there were various different magazines which had kind of, I guess, been teen magazines, you know. So in the 60s you had Rave, which had quite a lot of fashion in it. You know, it was very much part of the swinging London, Carnaby Street thing. And then it would have interviews with Jimi Hendrix or the Small Faces, you know, photographs of them in their flats wearing great clothes, you know, playing their little stereos. So that was going on in the 60s. Across the water in America, Rolling Stone was really making the moves by sort of encapsulating what was going on in youth culture and then setting it against the social and political backdrop. So by the mid-70s, you'd have people like Hunter S. Thompson going on the campaign trail. And so there was this kind of crossover, bleeding over from music, pure rock albums being reviewed and stuff like that and concerts being covered, to the area and the environment in which music was produced and consumed.
When The Face was launched in this context, as you've pointed out, there was some bleeding of the boundaries going on before, but what made it stand out on the newsstand?
It was the quality of the production beyond everything else. And so Nick said in there, why should the devil have all the best tunes? And so he wanted to make sure that what was considered ephemeral, mere pop music, mere top of the pops chart fodder, should be given great photography, great design work, good paper for a start with, you know, those kind of production values which were applied by everything from the Tatler and Parry Match, but hadn't been applied to this area of youth culture. And so he really started something new, which was to consider the ways in which music, fashion, design were consumed and project them in a very sophisticated manner.
It's interesting to see how the magazine developed throughout its career, which I think is fair to say. I know it went on until 2004, but obviously the two decades from 1980 till the turn of the millennium were really its heyday.
Well, they were the decades in which Nick Logan operated it. He sold it in July 1999 to EMAP, which was it's no longer, it's now Bauer, I think, but it was a corporate magazine publisher.
Got it, which changed the way it was produced?
I guess so, because once it was within a corporate environment, I see that one of the key aspects of The Face is its independence. And so he was kowtowing to nobody. He was answerable to nobody. And as long as he could charge a premium for the advertising, then he could be operating in this field where he basically was interested in feeding a relatively small readership. The biggest selling issue was 130,000 copies. And when you think that FHM in 1998, I think, was selling 770,000 copies. But there's a huge disconnect, not only in terms of sales, which are obviously to FHM's advantage, but in terms of impact, which are to The Face's advantage. Because those 100,000 people it was hitting up were tastemakers and were extremely interesting and interested people.
And did advertisers understand that? I mean, at the beginning, I imagine it would have been a hard sell to try to get advertisers to buy into something which looked so unusual and for which there was not necessarily a successful precedent.
I think the early days were quite tough. I mean, he always says that the first year was, you know, touch and go. He'd invested all of his life savings, which was £3,500, and put his house on the line for it. And so it was touch and go. But as it began to be recognised as the Almanac of Cool, as it was later called, then advertisers realised that, and particularly this kind of developing advertising industry, which was really growing in the early 80s, they began to see that they could target market what we would now call influentials. And so once he persuaded them of that, it was off. And it was only until the market became flooded or overloaded and overheated by the mid to late 90s, first by New Lad and then by, you know, things like magazines such as Wallpaper, where its constituency began to be chipped away at, and also advertisers no longer needed to pay those premiums to get to those readers.
Its heyday was two remarkable political eras in British politics. First of all, Thatcher's Britain in the 80s, and then the rise of New Labour with Blair in the 90s, which I think you could argue co-opted in terms of its aesthetic some of the youth culture which was laid down by The Face in the 80s. But do you see The Face as being a political publication, of having a politics, a coherent stance in that regard? And if so, what is it?
Well, I think more generally it was oppositional, because you have to consider that in the 19 years of Nick Logan's watch, 17 of them were under consecutive Conservative governments, some of which were extremely hard right wing. And so its mere existence, the fact that it expressed those views of acceptance and diversity and tolerance quite aggressively at times as well, meant that it was political. Sometimes it had overtly political pieces in there. But more generally, just the way in which it went about itself and the way in which its readers responded was an oppositional political act. Richard Benson, who was an editor in the 90s, says that the idea of New Labour, or if anybody mentions New Labour, it gives him the shivers, because it really was the beginning of the end, because the oppositional element had been taken away. And suddenly you've got this guitar-playing guy in at number 10 inviting Alan McGee and Noel Gallagher along to number 10 and wearing not bad suits for a politician and with having not a bad haircut. So in a way, the world became more face-like, or certainly Britain became more face-like. And so it's questionable as to whether The Face's function was there, had thereby run out.
Do you think you could launch or relaunch The Face or a face-like thing today and for it to have the same impact? Or would it just be instantly drowned in the sea of content and, you know, quite beautifully designed publications, which it's relatively much easier to make now? Anyone with Photoshop or InDesign can put one together. Will its success ever be replicated?
Yeah, that's a difficult one, isn't it? I mean, I'm by inclination anti-revivals. You know, I saw the New York Dolls when they came back, and I absolutely loved the group, and it kind of ruined it for me. It ruined the spell. So it could be argued that leave The Face where it is, because it was so important. The other thing to consider is that independent magazines are really booming at the moment. They may not be financially, but there is a really hot market out there for independent magazines, whether you're talking about Mush Pit or Galdem or Burnt Roti. A lot of these are edited and written by women, by the way, young women as well, which is really encouraging. And I think that there are strands of the face. You can see in them a legacy of the face. And in a way, they're kind of doing the job of the face at the moment. If I were to launch the face now, I'd make Brexit the absolutely dead centre of it, because that would draw on the heritage, as it were, of social awareness that ran throughout the face under Logan's watch. And it's also the issue that affects 16 to 30-year-olds, and it will be affecting those people in consecutive generations for the next 100 years. So I think that really, if you wanted to do the face now, or if I was going to do the face now, I'd really make that the centre of it and really give it a good go.
Paul Gorman there, in conversation with Henry, and Paul's book, The Story of the Face, is available now, published by Thames and Hudson. Time now for an introduction to a new magazine from Stockholm. Scandinavian Man presents a vision of masculinity that is, in its own words, style and design conscious, technologically innovative, and far ahead on sustainability and technology. To find out more, Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco spoke to the title's editor-in-chief and founder, Conrad Olsen.
Me and my business partner, Jonas Bergstrom, who I founded Scandinavian Man with, we started talking about this a little over a year ago. And the magazine launched in October this year, so a couple of months ago, actually. And Scandinavian Man was founded out of an idea, or basically the insight that menswear in Scandinavia needed a new platform to stand on. My business partner had been working with Fashion Weeks in Stockholm for a very long time. I come from a background of publishing. I was editor-in-chief of Plaza magazine in Sweden, and Plaza Uomo, which was our men's magazine. And we sort of looked at the menswear market and saw that none of the brands were really showing at the existing Fashion Weeks. There was this huge rise of menswear globally. It's really growing twice as fast as women's wear globally, and menswear as an e-commerce category is the fastest growing e-commerce category. So we saw that there's something happening in menswear. There's so much going on in Scandinavia. We need to create something. We came up with the idea of Scandinavian Man.
And who is in the cover?
He's actually a Swedish-Icelandic actor, and he was recently in the Borg McEnroe movie playing Bjorn Borg himself. So for us, you know, launching the Scandinavian Man to the world, we're sort of both launching Sverige to the world, and with the added bonus of having sort of one of the most iconic Scandinavian men, Bjorn Borg, on the cover. And I just recently heard that Sverige is going to play Mikael Blomqvist in the new Girl with the whatever the name is, movies, millennial movies.
Yeah, and he's looking great in the cover as well, I must say, with a lovely sweater.
I'm very happy about the cover. He's a very sort of gentle, cozy Scandinavian man with a sort of squishy acne sweater or cardigan.
Acne, that's good. Yeah. That's good for my shopping list now. And there's also another part that I thought it was quite nice. And you even use it with different paper, which is the mind section.
Yes.
You know, so you have some articles about Swedish concept of masculinity. I mean, if you can explain to us a little bit more.
I mean, it's important for, I mean, obviously menswear is sort of the foundation of the magazine. I think we have sort of 80, 90 plus pages of fashion stories. But it was also interesting to have something that's going to last, because it's a biannual, so it's going to last several months, to really have stories you can read. So we have, as you say, a section of the magazine called Mind, where we have essays on these values that I was talking about, sustainability, equality, sort of also how, you know, retail is developing, all these kinds of stories that are relevant to our world. And we work with different types of paper. We work with different types of paper stock. The magazine is, as you can see, it's a little larger in format than most magazines. It's got 244 pages. It's actually printed in Gothenburg in Sweden by Göteborgs Tryckeriet, that also prints Luncheon magazine that I know. I think Stack listeners are familiar with Luncheon magazine. And the paper itself is Munken, so it's a Swedish product in itself. So we're really happy to be able to work with this high quality, but keeping it within the borders of Scandinavia, not go to Italy or anywhere else to do it.
And actually, on the last page, I can spot here, Scandinavian Man issue 2, out March 2018.
Yes, for sure.
Are you already like preparing everything, the last details for the...
we're well on our way to produce the second issue. And we're very happy. We're going to launch the magazine here in London, actually, at the end of March. So one of the reasons I'm here, of course, to be here on the stack in Minori House, it's a pleasure. But I'm also meeting with some partners and locations to see how we can set up our launch event.
What about the business model? I mean, I can see that, you know, it's quite a healthy magazine in terms of advertising. Mm. But are you thinking of to do a couple of subscriptions? What are your plans for the expansion of the brand?
Well, naturally, we want to expand the service to the readers and make sure we have subscription services and all that. But the basis for our business model is to serve our partners in many different ways. So the magazine is the flagship product. It's what's visible, you know, to the world, and it's very concrete. You can pick it up and you can launch it somewhere. But what we actually make money out of is to create these launch events with our partners. You can call them advertisers. I call them partners because we do so many things with them. We do in-store events. They are with us. We did our big launch event in New York in October. So we had six brands with us there, ranging from Volvo to watches to shirts, etc., and to present these brands to the local fashion and community. So that's sort of one part of what we do as a business. Then we also do pop-ups at other fashion weeks and other fashion shows. So Scandinavia, we call it a platform. I haven't found a better word for it yet, but I want everything to be infused with the values and sort of aesthetics that you can see in the magazine.
If I may ask out of curiosity, how do you see the print industry in Scandinavia at the moment? It's a market I don't know very well. So how do you see the market for magazines? Is there an appetite for titles, well, for example, like yours as well?
I think it's similar to many other parts of the world. Naturally, the print industry has had its challenges. I think definitely monthlies are struggling with their business model, struggling maybe should they come out 12 times a year. In my world, fashion, you see a lot of the big fashion magazines in Scandinavia do other events, big galas. They try to find other ways to serve their advertisers. But what I think what I've learned, or what I see, is that there's an appetite for quality if you use it the right way. I think that's what's the most important thing. And to really go back, and if you're going to do something in print, don't do it, you know, half-arsed. Do it for real. Have a weighty paper stock. Have something, you know, that's really beautiful that you want to collect, that you want to save. And I think all your guests here on the stack can testify to this, that if you go out of your way to create something with quality and personality that really speaks to your reader, you can reach out. Then how you structure your company, your publishing house, and how you make a business out of it, I think that's very different depending on what you are. If you're a tennis magazine, if you're a business magazine, I think you can serve your audience and your advertisers in many different ways. But I still think the magazine, the printed magazine, we see it definitely, is always going to be on top, the flagship product, the thing you want to save.
That was Conrad Olsen speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and issue one of Scandinavian Man is out now. Finally, on today's programme, many of you will surely be familiar already with Popeye, Japan's self-styled magazine for city boys. It's one of the oldest titles in the world covering men's fashion. However, you're probably less familiar with Olive, Popeye's short-lived sister title. Thankfully, that could be about to change. The magazine for city girls, which had its original run in the 80s, is finally being reborn. Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, recently joined Henry Rhys Sheridan in the studio to explain more about Olive and about an altogether more flighty offering from Japan.
Olive was a very influential magazine in the 80s and 90s. It went out of print in the early 2000s. There was an attempt at a revival that was unsuccessful. But in its heyday, it was a must-read for university girls and for young women. And what it did was it introduced them to culture that was non-mainstream. I think there's a really good example in this Olive insert. It's 84 pages. It's a monster of an insert. And, you know, really, this is Takahiro Kinoshita, who's the editor-in-chief of Popeye. This is his baby. He really wanted to attempt a revival. So this is kind of a test for him to see how many readers out there actually want to read this thing. just in terms of things that Olive used to introduce, it would introduce things like French film. They would look at schoolgirls in Paris to see what they were wearing. They would look at the Shibuya Kei music scene, which was very influential in the 90s in Tokyo. This one in particular that I have in front of me takes a look at individuals. They look at a young woman in Paris. There's a young woman in Texas. There's one in New York, and there's one in Tokyo. And they kind of look at their lifestyle. They look at the items that they use on a daily basis. And, you know, they've chosen these four women because they have very particular and peculiar tastes. So, for instance, instead of a digital camera, they'll be using film cameras. They'll be diving in the local vintage stores, and they'll collect records, that sort of thing. And so this is really kind of an attempt to get away from the mainstream a bit to show that there's, for instance, an exhibition on the French photographer Horvat. And he's having an exhibition in Tokyo in early January. And so they introduce him, for instance. They do the ABCs of being a city girl, where they look at everything from tea to what schoolgirls should eat on a lazy Sunday. And they do a cultural talk where they go to one of the live music clubs and they talk to the people who are organizing events to see what sort of thing is happening in the middle of Tokyo that people might not be aware of.
So, Kenji, tell me a little bit about the relationship between the new rebooted Olive and the old Olive. How much does the new one resemble the old one, and at what point do they diverge?
That's a really good question, because when I spoke to Popeye's editor-in-chief, Kinoshita, he very specifically said that he did not go into the archive to look at old copies of Olive. He vaguely knows what the topics that they covered in the old magazines, but he didn't really want this to be an homage. He wanted this to be completely fresh. He wanted it to reflect the viewpoint of the editors at Popeye. Now, their slogan is a magazine for city boys. The Olive is the girls' version, so that would be the magazine for city girls. And so he really wanted it to reflect this worldview that he and his editing team of 10 people, and also some freelancers, have of the world, of Tokyo, of culture, and that sort of thing. Popeye's history is much older. Olive was released in the early 80s, in 1982, discontinued in the early 2000s. Kinoshita was responsible for Popeye's revival about 5 years ago. Its subscriptions were in the dumps. They weren't getting much in terms of ads. And somebody needed to come in and just give it a reboot. And he came in. And since then, if you look at Popeye's sales, they have more than doubled just in the past 5 years. It's full of ads. The stories are fresh. They're interesting. And it's also interesting because it's not just the target audience who are reading Popeye. People who are older, in their 30s and 40s and even 50s, are looking at this magazine just to see, you know, what the younger people are interested in. Also to see what Kinoshita is interested in, because he himself is in his late 40s. He's a very interesting and quite eccentric man. He doesn't have a cell phone, and he's very interested in non-mainstream culture. So there's a lot of interesting stuff packed in here.
And tell me a little bit more, if you can, about the men's and women's magazine markets in Japan more generally. Are they kind of equally healthy? Do they cover kind of equivalent topics, or is there quite a lot of specialization? I have no idea what it's like. It'd be so interesting to hear.
Well, there are about 3,600 or so magazines in Japan, and we're constantly seeing new ones coming out. Obviously, there are some that are going under as well. Japan is a market where magazines target very niche audiences. So, for instance, a magazine like Nonno would be for women of a particular age with a particular interest in a certain type of fashion as well. So the market is very, very sort of incrementally divided up. And these, really the danger for these magazines is that they're appealing to an audience that could be shrinking. At the moment, it's healthy, but as those readers move on to other things, as they get interested in other things, as they outgrow what the magazine has to offer, the magazine itself could suffer.
Kenji, talking about extremely niche publications, we have a second magazine in front of us. I can read just a few words on the front cover, and they are Leading Pigeon Magazine in Japan. what am I looking at?
You are looking at the leading pigeon magazine in Japan. It's called Aikyuu no Tomo, which the best translation for that is Friends of Loved Pigeons. It was founded in 1954 as a monthly. It's now a quarterly. Its print run is about 3,000 copies, and it targets the 12,000 or so racing pigeon owners in Japan, most of whom are in their 60s and 70s now. As you mentioned, it is Japan's leading pigeon magazine. It is Japan's only independent pigeon magazine. Just in terms of content, I like to think of pigeon racing as a competitive sport. You have your race drama and you have your kind of off-the-field drama. During the race, it's quite dramatic because the longer races can be up to 1,200 kilometers. Pigeons fly at around 60 kilometers per hour and without resting, and they find their way home over mountains, through storms, and they also have to evade hungry predatory birds like falcons and hawks. So it's quite a survival game for these pigeons. Off the field, in this magazine in particular, I've seen stories about stolen flocks. There are auctions where birds are selling for tens of thousands of euros, sometimes more. Race reports, breeding tips, what sort of medicines to get for the birds, what sort of things to feed them. And then one third of the magazine is just these identical pictures of standing pigeons photographed in profile and often with a zoomed in photo of the eyeball.
Yeah, so this is definitely the feature, shall we call it, of the magazine that jumped out most when I flicked through it. So it is a lineup of hale-looking pigeons, looking quite dignified, shot.
Very proud-looking.
Shot in profile. Nothing unusual about that. But above each pigeon is an extraordinarily detailed, zoomed-in picture of its eye and the skin around its eye, which is incredibly eerie and creepy to my mind. Why is that the convention?
Well, so it's interesting you mentioned this because the woman who took over running the magazine about 5 years ago, her name is Eri Myojin. She had no experience with pigeons when she started doing this. Her husband had been a longtime editor at the magazine. She wanted to remove the eyes. She thought they were spooky. But for some breeders, eye color matters. It's crucial to how they tell whether a pigeon is from the right bloodline.
The constitution to race.
Absolutely. And there is a huge amount of data out there, particularly for pigeons in Europe, that connects eye color and racing
aptitude.
Fortitude or aptitude. Yeah. So this is a very important piece of information for these breeders.
And Kenji, is pigeon fancying a widespread or accepted hobby in Japan? Give me a little bit about the history of that pastime in the country.
Okay, so raising and racing pigeons in Japan was big just after the Second World War. Some estimates put it at one in two boys having raised pigeons after the war. It was sort of their post-war version of a toy, really. And a lot of those boys went on to become, you know, went into the workforce. They have retired since then and come back to the sport. What we're seeing, though, is that it's very hard to get young people interested in the sport. Essentially, the breeders are doing it for the love of it. It's illegal to gamble on these races. In other words, you cannot win any prize money for winning a race. And raising pigeons is quite expensive. There's the food, there's the medicines, there's just kind of the daily rigors of getting up early in the morning, cleaning the cage, looking after them, and not being able to go on vacation because nobody else is around to take care of the birds. So, you know, in this time when we have so many other things to entertain ourselves with, and especially among young people with cell phones and whatnot, this group of people, this niche, is having a difficult time finding young blood.
Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, talking to Henry. And that's all for this week's programme. Thanks to our production team of Fernando and Henry, and to our editors, of course, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. Do feel free to clog up Fernando's inbox. You'll find it at fp@monocle.com. Don't forget to join us at the same time next week. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.